session number 11316, rule 3.
That were published in the...
So John Figgis, rule 3. Was anything sent to you either by the Japanese general staff or by other Japanese VIPs about the Russian action in coming into the Far East War in August 1945, because, of course, they had had a pact with Japan to keep neutral in that war. Was any opinion expressed to you about that?
No, but these were soldiers, not concerned with the politics. I think the Japanese people as a whole feared and disliked the Russians. And by that stage of the war, they felt themselves helpless to influence affairs in any way. They were totally defeated.
When and where did you have these conversations or interrogations with the Japanese general staff?
The Japanese general staff were formed into an office under the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, because everything was under the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers. This was an office for the demobilization and recovery of all the military personnel overseas. There were millions. And this office was manned by officers of the Japanese general staff, was organizing the recovery together in cooperation with the Allies of the hundreds of thousands or millions of Japanese surrendered personnel all over Southeast Asia and China and Korea and Mongolia and Manchuria. And the name of the organization was the exact name I'll have to think of later. But it was set up, and that was the purpose, to bring them all back. And of course, there was a tremendous restriction because there was no shipping. Virtually all Japanese shipping had been destroyed, sunk by us. And they had practically no shipping. So they had to borrow and scrounge shipping from anywhere they could find it to recover these troops, surrendered personnel all over, you can imagine, all over the Southwest Pacific, in Malaysia, in Hong Kong, in Burma. They were all there. And some were in Russian, and those in Manchuria or North Korea were in Russian prison camps. Some of those didn't get back for years. The ones in the Southwest Pacific came back over a period of 2 or 3 years. They came back to a devastated country and no employment, very little food. They all had to be looked after. And that was the job of the this Japanese general staff. And they also, of course, were required to respond to inquiries by interrogation by SCAP on every subject to do with the army or with the navy and, that they wished to inquire into. And naturally, the historians were there. There were all sorts of people there from America and from everywhere. Every power who had been connected with the war had questions that they wished to ask. Some of them missing people, missing prisoners. And then side by side were, of course, the War Crimes Commission, the War Crimes Trials. And so there was a large number of members of the Japanese forces, Japanese general staff and Japanese naval staff, who were assembled specifically to deal with all these terrific problems.
Did you make contact with your pre-war friends?
Yes, some of them I did. Some had been lost in the war, but others I met, and they were all very glad to see me.
Did they say anything of what they had been through in the war?
Not a great deal, because everybody had suffered and been through a very hard time. But one interesting thing is, and I've been asked about this by other people, in spite of what happened, in spite of the bombing and the cruel hardship and suffering, I never saw any sign of resentment against the Allied forces. All the time I was in Japan, and I would remain there with the short breaks until 1952. And I never saw any sign of resentment.
How can you account for it?
I think they were so relieved to have the war ended. And also you have to remember that the Japanese people themselves suffered terribly from the militarists, from the brutality of the military. The Japanese soldiers, these conscripts, suffered. We have always been told of the brutalities inflicted on our prisoners of war, which indeed were terrible. But the ordinary Japanese conscript soldier was treated in much the same way. Very little food, brutal treatment by the NCOs, absolutely no sympathy for any weakness. And so every Japanese family was likely to have had a son or a husband or a brother taken away and ill-treated in this fashion. So I think the whole Japanese people greeted the end of the war with a terrific... Once they knew that the Allied forces, occupying forces, would behave in a civilized fashion, which they did, they were so enormously relieved.
What about the Japanese civilian attitude towards the Navy, Japanese Navy?
Well, I think that they had always held the Navy in much higher regard, but remember, the Navy, there wasn't much left. The Navy had been destroyed. The ships, all the naval ships were sunk. Practically no Navy left. Whereas there were millions of Japanese conscript soldiers all over the world, all over the Southwest Pacific and Southeast Asia.
Was there not, in those post-war years, any opposition or resentment towards the process of westernization in Japan, so far as it was going on?
Oh, no. Far from it. Far from it. I mean, they welcomed it. They welcomed the American way of life as far as they could. I remember it couldn't have been more than a month after the surrender. Say 6 weeks after the surrender, going down the road, the old road, the road was in terrible condition, towards Hiratsuka, with a huge banner had been struck across the road which said, "Welcome Allied Forces, souvenirs for sale." Well, there's Japanese enterprise for you. There was no... What people have often asked me, there was no resentment. None. Even in Hiroshima. I think later there were people who tried to engineer, some years later, engineer hostility towards the Americans. That was a different thing. But immediately after the war, and for the next 2 or 3, 4, 5 years after the war, there was nothing like that. The Americans were greeted as saviors, and fortunately, under the firm, really firm discipline exercised by the American general, particularly an excellent general, was Bob Eichelberger, commanding the 8th Army. The occupying forces were under very tight control and behaved very well. There was little trouble.
So you could go about your daily business in complete safety?
Totally. Never heard. I don't think there was any case of anyone being... there might have been cases of Japanese girls being the odd one being mistreated by a GI, but not the other way around.
And there's never any question of your own personal safety from Japanese people?
None. Not, absolutely none from anybody. I think they also, the occupation, had learned something from what went wrong in Europe in the early days of the occupation in Europe. They had realized there must be some tight control over some things.
And there was no issue of the order in any equivalent of the order that happened in Germany, where a non-fraternization order was issued to British troops not to fraternize with the Germans?
No. I think that's one of the lessons they learned in Europe. They saw that that was not the kind of order that can be satisfactorily issued and obeyed, so it was not done. The only thing was, there were notices, no public display of affection where notices issued.
Meaning what?
Well, they didn't want to have GIs openly fondling Japanese girls. No public display of affection was an order. But what they did with the girl, if they had her in their own private quarters, that was all right, as long as it was a consenting girl. Of course, there were a lot of... there was a great deal later on, not immediately, but later on, there was a good deal of fraternization and marriages and, of course, quite a large crop of Japanese-American babies, which was an awkward issue for the Japanese rather than for the Americans, but it seems to have been sold. So the occupation worked pretty well. Then, of course, you had... Well, first of all, I should say an interesting thing which concerned me. In quite early on, in the autumn of 45, one of my jobs when I got there was to look after the Indian community. Because they were British Indians and still British subjects, and many of them had become traitors, if you can say that.
This was the Indian National Army?
No, I'm talking in Japan. The people, Indians living in Japan, merchants, people who lived in Japan and were caught there by the war. But they, of course, had no choice but to go along with whatever there was. But they hadn't been interned as other British nationals, civilians who'd been in Japan were interned, or other Allied nationals, for instance, but the Indians were not. And when we got into Japan, one of the things the Indians came along and said, well, we are British, can we have ration cards? Because the Allied nationals, since all Japan was nearly starving, Japanese were nearly starving, but the Allied nationals were allowed, given special rations. The small number of Allied nationals who were released from the internment camps. There were very few British, there were a few. But the Indian, and the head of the Indian community, came to me and said, well, we're British, can we have ration cards? A difficult one, because you could say, well, you weren't interned, you know, and on what grounds can you demand now to be recognized as British? However, there weren't so many of them, and it seemed that that was the only reasonable thing to do. So where it was clear that they had not done anything hostile, they were given ration cards. Well, quite early on, the leader of the Indian community introduced me to an Indian news man, journalist, and that chap came to me secretly and said he wanted to see me. And he said, "Bamo, the Burmese puppet, Prime Minister of Burma, wants to surrender to you. I know where he is. He's in the mountains in the north of Japan, but he doesn't want to surrender to the Americans. He wants to surrender to the British. And he would like to surrender to you." Well, of course, that was not possible, since I was only under the orders of the Supreme Command of the Allied Powers. We had no British independent entity. So I said, but I can take his surrender, but I can't do anything but hand him over to the Americans, so you must tell him that. And I was then taken to where Barmore was, and I met him. Of course, he was a very cosmopolitan, highly intelligent, highly educated man, spoke several languages, had been educated at the Sorbonne, spoke perfect English, excellent French, and I think was his partly Armenian by origin. But he had been Prime Minister of Burma and had been imprisoned by us. Well, I gather all, because he made a statement to me. I explained to him. I said, well, Mr. Barmore, you have to understand that under the terms of the surrender, the British have no independence here. I can take your statement and I can represent your views to the British government, but I have no alternative but to hand you over to the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers. Well, he understood that, and he made a statement to me where he said that he had run away. It was highly embarrassing, this, of course, for the Japanese Foreign Office, because what they had done was totally contrary to the terms of surrender. Barmore had persuaded, or the Japanese army foolishly had agreed to let him seek refuge in Japan, and they'd given him an aeroplane in Saigon and flown him to Japan and hidden him. It was a crazy, ridiculous thing to do because it was against all the terms of the surrender. But he said in his statement, and of course you can get all this if you wanted to from the Public Record Office because it's all there under Barmore, he said that he didn't want to be taken in Burma because he thought that in the heat of the moment he might be shot, killed, so he fled to Japan with the intention of giving himself up when tempers had cooled and things were calmer. I don't know whether that's true, but he was certainly a very interesting man, and he had something in his favour because we had imprisoned him in Burma on the grounds that he had said, I'm as Prime Minister, I will join the British in their fight against the Japanese. This was the time when the Japanese invasion started. If Britain will assure me that Burma will be independent after the war. The British government said no and put him in prison. All right, that was fair enough, but foolishly, in my view, we left him in prison to be released by the Japanese. So the Japanese released him and made him puppet Prime Minister of Burma. Well, I had these interviews with him, but I had no choice but to hand him over to the Americans. And I made a report back to Singapore, and so it was no doubt passed back to London too. And in due course we were told, well, he should be brought into the embassy and told that he was very wicked for having conspired with the Japanese, and that he should be returned to Burma. So he came, came with me into the embassy and spoke, and the ambassador was then Sir Alvaro Gascoigne, spoke to him in stern terms. And he was then returned to the Americans, who sent him back to Rangoon, where he was immediately incarcerated by the then Burmese government and kept in house arrest, I think, more or less for the rest of his life. But the whole story is certainly in the Public Record Office.
Do you remember when you had this interview with him?
Precisely not, but it was would have been October, November 45.
In Tokyo?
Yes, in Tokyo. But we did go. I went out with the Americans to the place where he'd been hidden foolishly by the Japanese army.
Was that far away from Tokyo?
Yes, it was in northwest Japan,
Northwest
Echigo, Echigo Yuzawa is the name of the place. Echigo Yuzawa in Honshu. Echigo Yuzawa. There's a silly plot by some stupid people of the Japanese army who I don't know what they thought they were doing. But then.
Was he in great fear?
No. He wasn't at all. He may have been in fear when he left Burma, because, as he said, in the heat of the moment, anything could have happened, but he was in no fear when he spoke to me.
What impression did you get of his attitude towards Britain and British people when you saw him?
Well, I was very impressed with him. I thought he was an excellent man. And I thought, my own view was that we had mishandled the thing. The governor of Burma in those days was not a very admirable person, I think, and subsequently that emerged. Pamo was a fine man. We could have played it differently. I mean, it would have made no difference to the Japanese invasion of Burma, no doubt, and probably would have made no difference to the ultimate thing. But I am glad to have met him and had that interview with him. He was an impressive man.
Was the relationship between the British and the Americans in Japan in those post-war years a smooth one, or were there any sources of friction?
There were sources of friction, mostly because of MacArthur. General MacArthur was a very vain man. He was brilliant but vain, and he couldn't bear any criticism. And there was a Times correspondent there called Frank Hawley, long since dead, Frank Hawley, who wrote rather critically of General MacArthur and his policies. Hawley was a Japanophile and a Japanologist. I mean, he really knew Japanese literature very well, had been in Japan pre-war, understood a great deal about Japanese literature. But he was a very odd man indeed. And he resented General MacArthur. And it came out in the critical material which appeared in the Times. MacArthur, of course, saw everything that came in the Times, and he resented this criticism, some of which I'm bound to say was ill-judged. But I think it's partly the personal resentment of someone like Frank Hawley, who really was a great expert on Japan, seeing someone who, by no stretch of imagination, was an expert on Japan, exercising authority in a way which he didn't care for. MacArthur didn't like this, and he was frequently calling in Sir Albury Gascoigne to complain, because we gave a stock answer, which is still given all the time. It's a free press. We have no control over what is written and what is printed. And if we're sorry about it, but if you don't like it, but there's nothing we can do. But there was that. I suppose there were other frictions. There was in 1946, the British sent an occupying force called the British Commonwealth Occupation Force, which consisted of a British brigade, an Australian brigade, may have been a few New Zealanders, and it was commanded by an Australian called Robert Robbins. He was called Red Robbie, and he was also a rather florid sort of character, and I think not very happily accepted by the Americans. But it was minor, all this. It was not at all serious. On the whole, certainly the troops, Americans and Australians and the British all got on very well. I think Red Robbie was a bit of a an awkward element in it.
What was the significance of red?
Well, he was red-haired. He was red-haired. So he was called Red Robbie.
Can we come on to 1949 and the going over of China to the communists and the consequences in the Far East? Do you remember the impact?
Can you, before that, just tell one more thing? You know about Subhas Chandra Bose?
Yes.
Subhas Chandra Bose was flying also improperly with the Japanese army. They tried to bring him, and he came in an aeroplane and crashed in Taipei, in Taiwan. The Indian army, the Indian government for a long time was very dissatisfied and wanted proof about this, because the rumours circulated, especially in Bengal, that he was still alive, that his death in Taiwan had been fabricated, and the Indian government had a lot of trouble. So I also had to investigate that, and I did a very thorough and long interrogation with the Japanese general staff and the Japanese officers directly concerned with that accident, and with his aide called Habibul, who survived with a badly burnt arm. But that is in the public record office. My whole interrogation and all the consequences of that accident in Subhas Chandra Bose.
You interrogated Habibullah, did you?
Yes, and I interrogated all the Japanese people who were concerned in order to send the report back to London and to the Indian government. So that, I think, is a possible interest, but it's in the public record office.
So you were able to satisfy yourself that there was...
Well, I had no doubt about it, because after all, I had actually the living presence of Habibul, who told me himself, so I never had any doubt. But the Indian government was worried. But the documentation finally satisfied them, and I think that canard was laid to rest.
This, of course, was the pre-47 in government of India.
Yes. And not only that, the pre-47 and the subsequent. It kept coming up, because the pre-47 government accepted it, but then the new independent...